Trigger warning. This podcast contains more common sense than most people can cope with. If you can't handle the truth, stop listening now. The conservative revolution starts here. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Hello, everyone. Corey Bernardi here. Welcome to another weekly dose of common sense podcast. Great to have you tuning in. And I'm recording this from the Canberra bunker. It's not really much of a bunker. It's my office up here in Canberra because the Parliament has resumed. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of July, a new financial year, a new Parliament, a new Senate. And I've just been down to see the Senate get sworn in, and I'm amazed at how many actually new senators there are. I asked one of the coalition team, they said there's 11 new people on their side. Now think about it like this. There's only 76 senators, 11 new ones on the coalition side. In Queensland, they're all new senators except for a Green, Larissa Waters. So I'm not sure how many are on the Labor side, but I'm guessing there's something like 15 new senators. On the crossbench, it's interesting because they're new senators, but they're also return senators. You've got a couple from the Centre Alliance. They didn't face election. I'm an independent now. I didn't face election. Jackie Lambie is back. Now, she's been my sparring partner for a little bit of time, but I just had a chat to Jackie, and I tell you, it's she's in pretty good nick. She feels good about the role that she's undertaking, and she's pretty keen to get on with it in a cooperative manner. So that's good. We'll no doubt have a couple of stoushes, but it's really good to open the door of dialogue there. We've also got, so that's four of us, and then there's a couple from One Nation, and one of those is Malcolm Roberts, who was disqualified under citizenship, and he's come back, he was elected again, so you've got Pauline Hanson and Malcolm Roberts. And the big topic of this week is, of course, what does a mandate mean if you get elected, and do Australians deserve tax cuts? Well, frankly, I think every Australian who pays tax deserves a tax cut. Unfortunately, there are some, Labor are unsure about it. One Nation thinks you don't. They think you don't deserve a tax cut. They think that you should embrace the 1930s scheme that was, you know, going to change the climate of Australia called the Bradfield Scheme. Now, I think that's a folly, I think, because you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can give people tax cuts and build appropriate infrastructure. But why deny the men and women of this country, the people who pay tax and support all the others who don't pay tax, why should we be denying them what is rightfully theirs? After all, these tax cuts are merely giving back the expectation of bracket creep in the years ahead. Now, isn't it better to get them legislated and then at the next election, let whomever wants to run on a platform of taking them away see how that resonates with the Australian people? I can't believe it. I just think it's doltish. I used that term last night on Paul Murray's show. Doltish means stupid. And I just think it's doltish to deny perhaps the most marginalised person in this country, the taxpayer, the person who gets very little for what they put out and what they contribute. And when you think that nearly half of the people in this country receive more in benefits than they contribute in taxes, if any taxes at all, aren't we expecting a heck of a lot from those who, you know, are an increasing minority or a reducing number? I mean, we can't continue to sustain the welfare state. We can't continue to discourage people from working with easy and abundant welfare and programs to subsidise everything. Much better off to allow them to keep more of their own money after working so that they can then spend it as they see fit. That way, they can be responsible for the outcomes of it rather than seek to blame someone else. And it also means that if you're not working and you're able to work, you've got an incentive to go out and do so because you should be better off just for any amount of money you get through paid work rather than remain within the welfare system. There is a dignity to it. It's important to your mental health, your physical health, and your well-being. And by removing some of these unnecessary and wasteful programs that are propping up people who really don't deserve it and are gaming the system, it allows us to focus on those who really do need help. And we talked about this last night on Paul Murray. It's winter. It's freezing cold. People are dying because of the cold. And yet when that was raised by Craig Kelly, a Liberal, a couple of years ago, he was pilloried and lampooned by his own side for telling that uncomfortable truth. Well, that is the truth. And I've done Meals on Wheels. I did a couple of years of that. And I saw people in the winter too afraid to put the heater on because they were worried about the cost. What has happened in this country when our needy can't afford to turn the heat on? When our pensioners can't afford to turn the heat on? When families can't afford to turn the heat on because of the price of electricity? Well, I tell you what it is. It's actually all about government intervention. Successive governments over the last 12 or so years have been throwing billions of dollars at intermittent, unreliable, renewable energy, pursuing some climate change mantra. And in the meantime, they've destroyed the electricity grid. They've destroyed the ability, the economic functionality of our baseload power, because it can't compete when the sun's shining and the wind's blowing. But you can't afford to turn it off and turn it back on again. And so our greatest competitive advantage, our greatest economic advantage, has been cheap, reliable, baseload power, mostly driven by coal. And what have we seen? A swag of politicians celebrate the demise of these coal-fired power plants. In South Australia, Labor championed blowing the coal-fired power plant up. It was cheered on by the now Premier, the Liberal opposition leader, who also walked away, might I add, from a nuclear industry for South Australia because it was politically advantageous. Aren't we all paying the price for that now? And one of the things in this Senate, I noticed that Keith Pitt and James McGrath, both from the Coalition, have picked up where we left off, which was about advocating nuclear power. I'll be reintroducing the nuclear power bill, but they want to have an inquiry into it to till the soil, prepare the Australian people, get their feedback about the benefits of the nuclear industry for this country. And it doesn't mean it's just going to be a nuclear reactor. There are many other types now that are out there. There are small modular ones, which are nuclear reactors. There's this thing called thorium reactors as well, which has a very different waste profile, and so on and so on and so on. I think when the Australian people are finally allowed to discuss it in a rational and sensible manner, the opposition to nuclear energy will be exposed as just more green posturing. But they've been forced to choose. Do they want to stop the planet from baking? Because apparently that's what everything else is going to do. Or do they want to prevent us from using perhaps one of the most abundant fuels that we have in this country? Why is it all right for us to send uranium overseas for other people to use, or send our coal overseas for other people to use, or our gas overseas for other people to use, but we can't do it here? The other thing that I think this Parliament's going to have to confront, and a lot of people have raised it with me, including many listeners to this podcast, have said, what are we going to do about our strategic fuel reserve? And it hit home to me the other day when I heard one of my former colleagues, John Wacker Williams on Adelaide Radio, former New South Wales Senator, talk about a load of polluted or infected or unclean diesel that arrived in Western Australia that basically couldn't be used, and that put enormous pressure on the diesel suppliers. And he made a very good point. If we don't have enough diesel, how do the trains function? How do the trucks function? How do the tractors function? How do your two-rack tractors function? These are really serious, genuine questions, and I think we've got to do something about our own energy stability, because it doesn't matter, as he made the point, it doesn't matter when you're at peace and all is good in the world, but it matters when there's tension in the world, and it matters even more for us when the South China Sea has been militarized by someone who often likes to flex their muscle. And if we can't export, if we can't import, if we can't use one of these most important trade routes because of some perceived slight or some aggression, then Australia is in a whole world of trouble. Anyway, we've got a lot to get through. I'm going to talk later on this. We're going to deal with your say, of course. I'm going to go back to the real challenge facing all of us, and that is conservatives, libertarians, you know, the Christians, anyone that believes in non-collectivism, the dignity of the individual, and the great Western inheritance we've all received. I'm going to bell the cat on the challenge we face, and that's going to be a recurring theme going forward for the next few weeks. So if you want to be entertained, you want to be amused, if you want to learn something so that you can share it with your friends, stay tuned. I'll be back with more of this week's podcast.
Keep listening. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
Thanks for staying with us. This is your weekly dose of common sense podcast. And you may recall that last week I referenced the Kenny Rogers song of the late 1970s, Coward of the County. And particularly, I mentioned the last line in the first two choruses. It says, "Son, you don't have to fight to be a man." Now, that is a worthy principle in benign times of order, functionality, and good inheritance. But, in the last line of the third chorus, after evil has infiltrated or men of bad will have acted or made their intentions clear, the applicable principle changes, and pertinently so. And Rogers says, sometimes you gotta fight when you're a man. Well, the same can be said about non-collectivists. You know, that's that group of conservatives, the Christians, the classical liberals, and many libertarians. Those that advocate for truth, accountability, duty, and personal responsibility, in addition to the freedoms and sanctity of the individual and the sovereignty of the nation state. Now, some of you might call them isms or ideologies, predispositions or mindsets. These groups, the conservatives, the Christians, the classical liberals, libertarians, have thankfully been dominant and instrumental in building the liberal democratic West. And it's built them, they've built it into the exceptional edifice we currently know and enjoy. Adherence to these groups that we broadly identified are inherently civil. They're peaceable, they're tolerant, pluralistic, cool-headed, non-collectivist, freedom-seeking, power-devolving people. Similar in many respects to their predecessors that actually built and shaped the West. Now, you can never judge the past through the prism or knowledge, standards or conditions of the present. But you can look at our ancestors and compare them with the rival forces of their times. And there is much in common with the conservatives and the libertarians and so on today as there were back then. For centuries, our predecessors remained vigilant. They were always on guard, confident of their principled intellectual and moral positions. They were confident as individuals, confident in their families, their community, and confident in the society that they were a part of. And they took action. And at each of these levels, they helped ensure that the underpinnings were there of the liberal democracy and the Western exceptionalism that we enjoy today. It was well understood, it was never forgotten, and it was inculcated in future generations. They passed on the lessons of history to the next generation because they wanted to preserve the lessons of past struggles, events, and history with their full and proper context. And that's important. It's not cherry picking, it's the full and proper context. They retained awareness of how we got to where we did and how they'd got to where they did. That was paramount to them. They had pride in our institutional and cultural inheritance, and they wanted to preserve it. And of course, when evil or wrongheadedness visited, or it emanated from within, like a healthy immune system, our predecessors would quickly identify the threat, raise the alarm, begin confronting it head on. They had confidence and conviction in what they were doing. They would flick that switch from close watching brief, if I can put it like that, to isolating and addressing the bad actor before its harm or mischief spread. So early infiltrations or societal cancers, you know, the early strains of Marxism or Marxist thought as we would describe it today, they were combated without doubt or fear of being impolite, offensive or awkward. Comfort zones and watching briefs could all be returned to once the harmful threat had been contained or neutralised. And the sooner this was done, the better for both current and future generations. And going back to Kenny Rogers, sometimes you have to fight when you're a man. Well, conservatives and fellow non-collectivists that cherish individual freedoms, prosperity, reciprocity, order and civility need to take note of this. Like it or not, we are the Praetorian Guard of liberal democracy and Western exceptionalism, because it was our predecessors with their principles, their mindsets and their determinations that built, refined and bequeathed this amazing inheritance to all of us. We need to build, refine and bequeath it to the next generation in a better condition than we actually find it. And that's why we can't afford to walk off the job or shirk the contest or keep our heads down. We cannot stay politely in our comfort zone. Our freedoms, our acquired wisdom, societal functionality will be quickly lost to the neo-Marxist forces of narcissism, totalitarianism that are now so firmly entrenched and ascendant in the West. Many of you would have followed the Israel Folau saga. Well, that shows it is no longer sufficient to merely tolerate the rainbow Trojan horses of PC identity politics that neo-Marxists have unleashed upon us. There are a myriad of others too. It's not just the rainbows, but you know, that's the trend of the moment. Because unless you're also feeding, grooming, overtly celebrating and fully endorsing these tools of subversion, this identity politics, which is subverting all of us, then we will be targeted. We will be deplatformed, made radioactive, chased out of the public space. It's a form of social gulag, but I suspect with a much harsher form, no doubt, targeted in the future. And so we can't remain silent anymore. It is no longer sufficient for conservatives to just simply keep the economy strong and working well. We've got to get out of our comfort zones. We've got to prepare the trenches, get our hands dirty in the culture wars, because the Marxist and Islamist enemies of liberal democracy never rest. They never give up, and nor can we. They only have setbacks, which they quickly regroup from when we band together. So we have to band together. We have to continue to fight on the enemy's chosen battleground. And they move it all the time. When the climate change myth and man's anthropogenic climate change creation has been subsumed or subdued, they move on to indigenous recognition or some other thing. And then when that's been done, they move on back into identity politics again, and then back into the rainbow, and then it goes a full circle. We come back to the climate change wars again. They never give up, and nor can we. Whatever role we all have to play, whether it's about communication, whether it be publicly in public life or in the media, conservatives, libertarians, Christians, classical liberals, whatever, anyone who believes in the dignity of the individual and the amazing inheritance that we've all had and that we want to bequeath onto others, you need to get active. That's the message of today's Common Sense podcast. Get out there, pick up your cultural spear and get into battle. Welcome back. This is your weekly dose of common sense. And you know, I love Australian history and I love talking to people about it. And so I want to discuss with you briefly a legend of Australia, a person whose name will be familiar to many of you, although some of you probably wouldn't know about this great man's achievements. And I'm talking about Sir John Monash. He was born in 1865 in Melbourne's West on the 27th of June. He was a civil engineer, a surveyor, an attorney, a champion of veterans, master public administrator, and Australia's most famous forces commander. Now, he began his illustrious military career in 1884, going on after a lot of study, attainment of degrees in engineering, construction, etc., to serve at Gallipoli in 1915 as commander of the 4th Infantry Brigade. And after promotion to Major General, he commanded the 3rd Division in France the next year. And in 1918, Monash was knighted by King George V in recognition of his role in the Battle of Hamel Hill, his greatest victory that inspired a succession of victories, culminating in the breaking of the Hindenburg Line. Now, after World War I, Monash returned home. He became Director General of Repatriation and Demobilisation, which was a fancy title about being responsible for the return of Australian troops from Europe and their return to civilian life. In the early 1920s, Engineer Monash was appointed General Manager and later Chairman of the State Electricity Commission of Victoria. The commission developed affordable, reliable coal-fired electricity from the Latrobe Valley, distributed, it took a little while, but distributed across Victoria. Monash then became Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne from 1923, with his final years instrumental in having Melbourne's Shrine of Remembrance built. In 1958, nearly three decades after his death in 1931, Melbourne's nationally top-ranked Monash University was named after him. Now, if you don't know what Monash looks like, get a $100 note. Because since 1996, the green polymer note has honoured Monash on its reverse side. On the other side is world-renowned Federation-era soprano Dame Nellie Melba on the front, but Monash is on the reverse. So, we've got to do all we can to recognise this great man's legacy. And there's been so many things that have been named after him. I mean, the city of Monash in southeast Melbourne council area, the Monash Freeway, the Riverland town of Monash near Berry in South Australia. It used to have a fantastic playground there until it was taken away because it was too dangerous. The suburb of Monash in Canberra, the Monash Medical Centre. It's a teaching hospital in Melbourne. And in April of last year, the Sir John Monash Centre, a museum and interpretive centre at the Australian National Memorial near Villers-Bretonneux in France. That commemorates Australian servicemen and women who served on the Western Front during World War I. Listeners, Sir John Monash, an Australian legend, an extraordinary record of service, both in service of our country overseas, but also at home, where a lot of the things that we're enjoying today have been credited to him, attributed to his legendary style of service. We should be grateful. We should remember. So take one of those $100 notes if you happen to come by. Pop down to the RSL, get yourself a snitty and a pint of beer and have it in celebration of Sir John Monash, born 27th of June, 1865.
Dose of Common Sense.
Welcome back. This is your weekly dose of common sense. I'm Corey Bernardi, and it's time for your say. And before I kick off, there's a bit of self-indulgence here because my kiteboarding instructor, Easto, that's you, mate, has ticked me off because I referred to pulling the chicken cord. He says it's the chicken loop, and he says that he taught me better. Well, not that anyone cares. It's the abandon all hope that ye who pulls this cord because you're doing it because you're in a world of trouble. Now, Easto wouldn't have pulled that cord for a very long time because he's very good at it. But he's obviously a better kite surfer than he is an instructor because I'm no good at it. Or maybe you've just got a bad student, Easto. But thanks for listening to the podcast, mate. This is called Payback. Anyway, to the rest of you, dear Mr. Bernardi, this is from David. He says, are our representatives prepared to man, he said he should be careful there, to man up and start to defend our free speech and indeed our civilization? I'm concerned the roots of our society are under attack in that Israel Folau has been fired and continues to be maligned by the mainstream media for in effect quoting from the Bible. What next? Also, and of course no word of criticism for that other book that prescribes a much more immediate threat to sinners. Hey, you're right, David. The other book, of course, is the Quran, which says, you know, you're allowed to kill sinners or they should be put to death. The Bible doesn't say that, not the New Testament anyway. But look, there is a big deal here that's going on. It's not just about freedom of speech. That's been under assault for some time, and that's why I want to reform the hurt feelings test in the Human Rights Act. But it's about defending our civilization. It's about sticking up for things. And Israel Folau, there are intricacies in this because the question of coercion by sponsors. It's a question of, is there a contractual breach? Well, I don't know the answers to those things. But what I do know is that people recognise this is like the tip of the iceberg. That if, as a private individual, you can be held to account by your organisation for quoting from a book like the Bible, no matter if people agree with it or not, then it opens up a massive, massive can of worms. Where does your work life end and your private life begin? I believe in the right, and I've written this. I wrote about it in the Australian last week. I believe in the right of businesses to act in rational self-interest. So I'm not defending Israel Folau from, you know, the termination of his contract. If he's got an agreement, he's got an agreement, and that's one dispute. But I also recognise that people want to marginalise Christians in the public square. And I can tell you now, there wouldn't have been one iota of complaint if it was a Muslim that made those same comments about people going to hell. We're into the realm of competing rights. It's very dangerous, David, very dangerous. And that's why I've said earlier in the podcast, you can't turn a blind eye to it. You've got to get in and get into the battle. Scott says, "Dear Senator, I read your thoughtful newspaper article about religious freedom with interest." Hey, there you go. I was just mentioning that, Scott. "We do already have laws in this country prohibiting business from refusing to serve and thereby discriminating against members of the public based on, amongst other things, religious belief and religious activity. From what I've read, there's a real question about whether GoFundMe has attempted to dress up its decision to refuse its fundraising platform to Israel Folau as a breach of its terms and conditions, when in truth it is an exercise of retained contractual discretion for a prohibited reason." Well, Scott, this is the point, right? I believe that it's okay for the baker to say, "I don't want to bake a cake or decorate a cake for a gay wedding," because that's a personal service that you can decide who you want to give it to or not. I've been on the receiving end of that, of people who don't like my politics for web development or something like that, because how can you expect someone who's, you know, terribly left-leaning to work on a conservative website and put their all into it? Isn't it more respectful and dignified to say, "Look, you know, I really don't want to work with you"? Don't take it personally. It's not like you're being, you know, denied petrol in a service station or something. But ultimately, I believe that you're allowed to uphold your own standards, and I think businesses are allowed to uphold their own ethos. But I agree with you in the sense of, I think GoFundMe have probably just caved into the progressive juggernaut or regressive juggernaut. But ultimately, they should be able to say, "No, we don't want to provide you with this platform. I don't care if it's a prohibited service or not. Let an alternative spring up along the way." But what irks me is the fact that it's a one-way street, this discrimination. Because the same clowns who say, "Oh, you shouldn't be allowing Israel Folau to raise money for that cause," will allow Sarah Hanson-Young to raise money for her cause, for her legal site. These so-called celebrities, you know, the ones that go to the Logies, all saying, "Oh, GoFundMe wasn't designed to raise money for legal causes. It's designed to raise money for sick kids." Well, you know, where were they when David Lionhelm and Sarah Hanson-Young are raising money? Where are they when it's one of their favourite causes? I mean, they're hypocrites writ large, and it's all over the place. And so if you're going to apply a rule, apply a principle. Don't just cheer on a tribe or a side. I think that's where it gets wrong. Ian, on a theme here, "I'm sick of the left's attack on the Folaus. First, these airlines put pressure on Rugby Australia, now ANZ, HCF and Suncorp, etc., regarding Maria Folau's support for her husband." Well, that's another thing. Maria Folau simply put on Twitter or retweeted her husband's fundraising appeal to raise money for his legal costs. And then HCF and ANZ have all come in and tried to criticise her and condemn her. My goodness, the world has gone completely bonkers. I've said as much for a very long time. Andrew says, "Would like an opinion. With the current fight on free speech with Israel Folau," here we go again, "the ACL, which is the Australian Christian Lobby, has come a little into the limelight. What are your views on the ACL? He goes on and say, "I'm looking for an alternative, smaller party." Well, the ACL are not a political party. They're a lobby group. They do a mighty job, uncompromising, do an excellent job. Martin Isles is really incredible for a young man. He's very articulate, prepared to wade into battle to protect the freedoms. Because at the moment, whether you're a Christian or not, Christians are in the crosshairs. And once the Christians have been marginalised and sidelined and silenced, then they'll come for someone else. So you've got to cheer on the principle here and understand that Christianity is the underpinnings of Western civilization. Without it, we don't have the nation that we have today. Gregory says, over 50, made jobless by GFC, being forced by Centrelink into age and disability support training courses on the promise of jobs on completion, which do not exist. It's not a question, it's a statement. Well, I guess retraining, I don't know all the details, Gregory, but the retraining is important, and there are jobs in aged care, disability support training courses. There's plenty of jobs. They can't get them. And in fact, in aged care, a lot of the jobs are taken up by new arrivals or recent migrants because they can't get people to do them locally. So if there is an opportunity, embrace it. Alan says, good to see nuclear power on our minds. Love the liquid fuel modular approvals in Canada, USA and Indonesia. Still making rapid progress in thorium vice uranium too. Well, there you go. Thanks, Alan. I think this is a really important thing, and I think it's going to keep growing as we need baseload power. People demand it be environmentally friendly, and we've got so much uranium and technology is moving on. Jamal says, I'm subscribed to your podcast and have noticed just recently I can no longer listen to them. Never had a problem before. When I try to play them, I get a message saying audio file could not be played due to corrupt file. Or my browser doesn't support the format. Never had this problem before. I've not changed any software, so I'm wondering if the people that are scared of our way of thinking have somehow gotten you censored. I've seen a lot of this on YouTube lately. You start a video about 5 seconds in, it jumps to another totally unrelated video. Well, Jamal, I'm not getting into that. You won't be listening to this if you can't hear it. But anyway, I don't think there's been any conspiracy about it. Plenty of people are managing to listen to the podcast. Our numbers grow every single week. I hope you can get back on board with it. I'm not sure what the problem is there, mate. If any listeners perhaps have a solution or have encountered a similar problem in the past and how they fixed it, let me know, corey@coreybernardi.com. Brian says, I'm not a Christian. Not because I like attending a church, but he says, I am a Christian. Not because I like attending a church, but as a disciple of Jesus. I'm emailing because there's a troubling rise in anti-Semitism throughout the Western world. The so-called civilized world is beginning to increase here in Australia. The rising anti-Semitic hatred is changing Jewish life across the US with huge amounts of money being spent on security and defense strategies. We here in Australia are not impervious to this alarming rise in anti-Semitism. Well, Brian, you're right. You're absolutely right. The Jews are coming under attack, and you'd be surprised at how many people who want to identify in the conservative space want to blame the Jews for things. They've got more conspiracies blaming Jews than ever before. And of course, it's on the left as well. We know in the green space, in the nationalist space, in the Labour Party, there's the increasing anti-Semitism. You look at what's happening in the UK with Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, once again, we are going back to a dark time where we're seeking to identify people by religion, race, ethnicity. We're seeking to carve them out as somehow special in a positive sense or a negative sense, to attribute them with special or rights or privileges, and to marginalize others. It's wrong. We have to learn the lessons of history. And anti-Semitism, anti-Christianity, it's like Westophobia, whatever, is a danger to us all. So get in there, speak up about it, write to your newspaper about it. Because it's, you know, if you're only going to leave it to others, you'll be a victim yourself eventually. Peter says, hi, Corey. During your podcast, you suggested the use of nuke power to run desal plants to provide water for irrigation. No opposition to nuke power, although I do have some reservation on the use of desal plants over natural water storage where possible. Well, Peter, you're kind of right. I mean, I'm with you on dams and all of those sorts of things, but I was talking about a value add proposition for South Australia in one of our very arid areas. A nuclear power plant, if it was water cooled, would require a desalination plant as well. That water could then be used as to add value by irrigating vast swathes of arid lands, because there isn't any, you know, meaningful rivers to dam, and the topography is not right for it. So it was just a way of adding value to the South Australian economy and proving that there are more than one way to skin a cat. And so it would also make nuclear power much more affordable. But that was just a study from MIT based around my state of SA. Francis says, can you please put through a bill or whatever is needed to bury once and for all the medical illegal refugee scam that allows illegals to come here via the pretense of illness as directed by two so-called doctors? You're talking about the Medivac legislation, Francis. I think the government wants to repeal it. They're looking for the numbers. I did everything I could to delay it and stop it and point out all the things that have gone wrong subsequent. They were all evident to anyone that wanted to see it, but we had all these gooses who wouldn't listen to truth. And one of them actually now has a show on Sky on Thursday night. That's you, Darren Hinch. Kate says, I'd like to go to a Trump rally in the US. Do you have a group heading over? No, Kate, I don't. But I think I've convinced my wife that I should go over there and with her for maybe the US election season for a couple of weeks next year. If she's listening to this, she'll probably say no now. Well, maybe the shopping will be good. Graham says, can I ask your strategy to isolate a total personal loss once debt has hit the limit and things come crashing down on us? Well, okay, you go on about a whole range of things, about houses and interest rates and stuff. Look, debt is a massive issue. I think it is going to hit us, but you know, there's only three ways out of debt. You either default on it, you pay it back, or you inflate it away. And I think governments are desperate for inflation, so that the debts that have been accruing over the last decade or more will diminish in real value as the value of money diminishes too. And that will help anybody that has property assets, or real assets actually, and it could only be a couple of years away. Lynn, words of praise for CB. Oh, I like these. This should have been at the top of the show. I've been very worried about you, and I'm pleased to hear you won't be rejoining the Libs. Well, thank you for your worry, Lynn. I appreciate that, but no need to worry about it. But clearly, you're concerned about the AC, but a failure is only when you do not try, you say. Well, thank you, Lynn. I appreciate that. We gave it a best shot. Maybe we made a difference. Time will tell. Gary, same vein. I'd like to start by saying thank you and your team for your hard work. I'm disappointed the party will be deregistered. It's still a place, but at least stay in Parliament, be a voice for common sense that Australia so badly needs. I will very much miss the podcasts. I've learned a lot along the way. Well, Gary, podcast is still coming, mate. I made that clear last week. It was in these podcasts I learned why, if we have a certainty in policy and regulation, it would be better to have a private power system. Also discover why a $1,000 tax cut is better for all Australians than a $1,000 pay rise. You also have had many great interviews. Credit to you that you have been able to sit down with someone totally opposite point of view and have a civil conversation with them. Well, thank you, Gary. I appreciate it. Shane says, you inspired me to consider a career change into politics, as I also agree with your comments regarding the direction the country is headed, as well as keeping the Greens out of the picture as much as possible. Thank you, Shane. Michael says, sorry to hear about the Australian Conservative Party. Thank you for all your good work. Maybe you should take a leaf out of Mark Latham's book and join One Nation. We need people of passion to wake up the sleeping populace. Thank you, Michael. I won't be joining One Nation. It's Pauline Hanson's One Nation. And there's lots of things in there I'm sorry, I really just don't agree with. You know, their economic rationale is not consistent. It's not coherent. They're capricious. They change their minds all the time. And that's not to say Mark Latham does. In fact, most of what Mark Latham says today, I agree with. It's just divergent from where his federal party is at. Angie says, thank you, Corey, for being a man of integrity, good values and morals, and one who has put the best interests of this country ahead of politics and self. Our family all very proudly voted for the Australian Conservatives and what you stood for. I'll be eagerly looking forward to your blog each week. As far as we are concerned, what you did with your party was a resounding success in bringing back conservative values and waking those in Canberra up to some reality. Well, thank you, Angie. And listeners, just in case you think I'm getting carried away with this, what about this from Michael? the election humiliation and your slide to irrelevancy. Looks like finally got the dose of common sense you've desperately needed all along, you smug, supercilious prat. Michael. That means a lot to me because I can't believe someone who disagrees with me actually listens to the podcast. Someone who hates me so much tunes in just to get angry. I mean, Michael, you're everything that's wrong with the country. Anyway, that's your say for this week. Let me know what you think. Corey at CoreyBernardi.com.
This is the home of the conservative revolution. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Well, members of the common sense community, that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of your weekly dose of common sense podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I love producing this for you. I love coming to you from the bunker, whether it be in Adelaide or Canberra or Coffin Bay or wherever I am in the country. I'm trying to instill a weekly dose of common sense. So share it with your family and friends. Get the common sense message out there because the job is not done. Tune in again next week and we'll go on another common sense adventure.
This is your weekly dose of common sense.